You know him very well. He's the one who thundered the news about the Guptas offering him money. And that helped South Africa have a much better conversation about state capture, and now have a Zondo Commission. We have a different South Africa, but there are concerns. You've seen unemployment. There are many other things that bother me every day. It's about people traveling to work and leaving homes at 4 a.m. To be at work, and they come back at 10 p.m. because things are very, very difficult. We have an army, a massive army of unemployable people, not just people who are unemployed. And the labor market can only absorb so many people who are unskilled. And our problems are deep, that the many compatriots we have will simply not get jobs in their lifetime. And this is in the National Development Plan. When the National Development Plan breaks down the South African problem, it says, it was Trevor Manuel who articulated this so well, that there is a Tandi. A Tandi is a prototypical South African. Tandi will escape poverty only when she becomes 60 and eligible for an old age grant. And then she repeats the cycle of poverty and difficult, and her children will only escape poverty when they get an old age grant one more time. Here we are. Let's have this conversation. Welcome, Ramse, and thank you for joining us. Our guest, Mr. Jonas.
Well, thanks. Thanks to the listeners, too.
How are you feeling? Tell us about you, your space, where you at? What do you do every day?
I don't know even now. But no, look, I mean, I think I'm doing a couple of things. I mean, when I kind of do my work on the boards I sit on, I still do a lot of research work and around policy and options for South Africa. We're in the process of putting together a book now on choices for South Africa with a couple of people. I'm just an editor. I'm writing one chapter. But I think we're doing a lot of things. I think, difficult times for business, difficult times at a political level.
How difficult is this situation when the ruling party cannot ready itself to register enough people to contest a broad part of South Africa? We know we have problems. We have our electoral system is not that competitive, and we still have what some say is a one-party dominant system, never mind the presence of the EFF and the DA. What are the consequences of the possibility that the ANC might not be represented in some countries?
That would be terrible. I mean, clearly that would be terrible in many ways. But again, I mean, you must look at the challenges and problems facing the ANC in historical terms. I think you've seen the decline, I would argue, coming all the way. I mean, since I think we started in 94, we had a formidable party that transitioned itself into a formidable movement that transformed itself into a political party. My sense is that that process was never kind of carried to its full, to the full in the first instance, because I think in many ways it was more strategic and advantageous for the ANC to sustain the liberation movement narrative as it moves into a political party. And therefore, I think those imperatives that characterize a political party, focus, singular ideological orientation, kind of unified vision perspective, we're kind of left behind. I think ANC has never achieved them, quite frankly, if you ask my opinion, since that time. You've always have like a kind of a marriage of left centrist, and sometimes even elements of right-wing politics within one party, as it were. So factionalism actually was at the base. Now, put on top of that, contestation for resources and positions, which almost like obliterates even those ideological differences. And sometimes what we see is factions based on ideology. In essence, sometimes factions are based on access to resources, access to positions, and that's all. It's a typical situation when those who hold political power don't have economic power, and those with economic power don't have political power. And I think that dichotomy in itself is the bedrock for corruption and state capture anyway.
Okay. So if we had to just look at the problem in its historical context and maybe give a score, maybe even in a qualitative ranking to it, how bad is the situation now compared to, say, the year 2000? I remember in the 2000s, the ANC was coming out of the previous decade of being ready to govern and get into power, and then it discovers that there's a problem. It says the problem is careerism, and everybody uses, wants to get the rewards of being a governing party and all the problems with in incumbency. How do you now compare that state 20 years ago to where the ANC is now?
Look, I mean, it's we're kind of in a worst position in a sense, you know, because I think if you think about it, at that period in part, I think there was still a semblance of an agenda, so to speak. I mean, that and also there was pretty much strong leadership to a certain extent within the party. Of course, many of the problems we have were already expressing themselves. The issues between the dichotomy between the alliance and the divisions between the alliance and the ANC, some ideological, some about how the alliance should be managed and structured, and so all of those things were there already. But there was, in a sense, I mean, stronger leadership at a national level, if you like, and also I think the kind of degeneration that you see in at a local level was not at the level at which it is now. I think what has happened, I think, with the ascension of after the Polokwane conference, I think what you've seen escalation of degeneration. In part, I would argue that, I mean, think about it, the only kind of province that performed well immediately after JZ took over, it was only KZN, quite frankly. And it's interesting because if you think about it, many provinces, I mean, didn't perform as well. And part of the explanation for that good performance could be the fact that a lot of Inkatha become weaker, and a lot of some of the Inkatha members joined the ANC, and so on and so on and so on. But also, it actually set in motion, I think, another dimension, or give it fueled it stronger. The dimension that provinces started becoming so central in determining national leadership. So effectively, I always joke and say that you're gradually having an organization that has less of a national leadership, or an organization that has a provincial leadership trying to play a national role in the NEC. And I think about it, I mean, Sub-Secretary General, who is a provincial leader, who's trying now suddenly to play a provincial a national role. So effectively, I mean, tribalistic tendencies and geographic kind of arithmetic determining national leadership implies in other ways that quality is going down, and both coherence also is going down, because people would actually always go back to their provinces to consolidate their positions and fight better the factional battles. So for me, that's a problematic scenario. Successful movements need coherent national leadership. That's of course it has to be rooted in provinces somehow, but I think it has to have national credentials in a sense, and see the national question as the central focus, or the national agenda as the central focus.
Okay, what you just said actually is this quite an intriguing analysis of the setup. I can see it in the Nasrec election, where you have these provincial barons, I'll call them. More liberals, my language than you are, I would imagine, as a politician. But anyway, that's not an offense. I guess. You have a David Mabuza comes from is a strong man from a province, East Mahashule, and that is this how it plays itself out, the issue of the leadership coming through the provincial ranks and a newer kind of leadership in the
inside. That's the one side of the thing, but there's another phenomenon that started even before that. I mean, I come from the Eastern Cape, so you had this interesting thing that has been happening quite kind of quietly within the movement. I think it's the fact that you have in many provinces a lot of former Bantust and bureaucrats being integrated into provincial public administrations, and many of them ended up being chairpersons of ANC, and many of them ended up being leaders in the ANC. So that's another kind of bringing a different, completely different culture. So you ask yourself, what is ANC culture post 94? And it at some point you lose it because of all of these imperatives you have, like and then impose on them interest and other things like that. So my point is that the failure to kind of reform change a liberation movement into a political party proper, in a sense that you have coherence and you have clear agenda, you try to drive it coherently and so on and so on, it has its other consequences that I think you cannot be able to manage now. I mean, the July unrest is an interesting point, a case in point, because it flows directly from divisions within the ANC. People can try to massage it and say, no, the constitution was threatened. Certainly it was. It was under threat. Democracy was certainly under threat. But it was under threat because of failure to manage political problems within the African National Congress, the ruling party.
Okay. So how could this former liberation movement be brought back in line, or for it to reform itself into a modern political party?
Look, the imperative is there. I think the positive thing is that there are lots of discussions internally at the moment, and there are lots of views about how that should happen. But also the sheer if you have to sustain to sustain itself in power, obviously it has to deal with some of these issues, obviously. So for me, an active citizenry is important. Because I think if you're expecting that an internal momentum will lead to what the ANC calls renewal, you probably might never have renewal. So quite frankly, when I look back to the state capture fight and the fight against corruption, it's not the internal momentum within the ANC that actually ensured that there is a massive reaction and massive kind of action against state capture. It is the external momentum from civil society organizations, maybe media also, but also maybe kind of judicial findings and judgments, et cetera, that actually coalesced itself and had the positive impact that it had on the party. So my view, I'm saying you do need to kind of activate citizenry. You do need to give citizens something to stand up for. And at the second part, of course, many people would argue is also elections. The electoral system, itself. The more you kind of bet the electoral system on constituencies, the more you're likely to have better outcomes in terms of public accountability, et cetera, so a combination of all of those things might actually force a change on the party. Already, many of the things that the ANC is talking about now, are not things that were initiated within the ANC. They come from momentum in the civil society, et cetera. Of course, these are, if you would argue, part of the broader principles that the ANC was founded on, but they were lost.
So you're saying it is possible to have a broad conversation, a high-level, matured conversation about South Africa without that necessarily being driven within the ruling party. Practically, how do we do that, and how do we bring...
Look, I guess the first prize is the leadership of the ANC realizing that they've got to initiate a different conversation in society. Of course, the second issue is going to be credibility issues and etc. But I think it would be a first prize to have people realizing that you need to mobilize society in a slightly different way, get society talking about different issues and substantive issues, and lead a process of finding that consensus. Is that possible? I don't know. My view is that I think you might. It's a dream that all of us have. But I think on the other hand, you're beginning to see society rising and asserting itself. I mean, in ways that we never imagined. I mean, think about it. In the July, during the July uprisings, you have communities rising themselves, organizing themselves to say this is not going to happen here, and it's an interesting thing because it actually means that it's possible. You're seeing in other parts of the country communities organizing themselves and in ways that were unthinkable around service delivery, around different things. Of course, all of those things still have weaknesses because in some instances, some of the service delivery protests are actually reflections of ANC fights. So someone decides to go and mobilize community so that he kind of fights his internal battle. But still, sometimes you have genuine ones where there's mobilization, there's clear vision, there's perspectives emerging, and so on and so on. And there are debates, interesting debates in civil society about, I mean, the vaccine issue has been a very robust debate around it in civil society. So my point is you're beginning to have that. But I think it needs to be scaled up. And how do you do that? My view is that I think it's a leadership issue. I think you need to look at, a stronger leadership in civil society. The work done by Cathedra Foundations and another activist forum like SACC and so is actually useful to coalesce and into a stronger movement.
Okay, now interesting. I'd like us to move to a couple of topics, but before we do, I would like to invite anyone who has a question or input. With my co-host Arina and Sanusha, we'll make sure that you do come through, and we'll take inputs from Arina and Sanusha as well. Anytime you guys want to fire away a question, there are a couple of topics. I remember following Mr. Ramaphosa around when he became deputy president of the ANC, and I asked him a sport question. What are your two priorities? And he said, health and education. We never got to get deeper into how he would do anything around it and make sure there's a tangible difference. But looking at where we are, I'm worried that the picture is getting worse with regards to education outcomes, investing in education, whether it's early childhood development right through the system. The same on the public health. And with this COVID environment, we've squandered opportunities to make tangible infrastructure investment and our public health system. And the biggest issue is that life is becoming very expensive for all South Africans, whether you are a cushioned professional who has access to medical aid or a person who doesn't have. If you are a professional, you pay more to access basic services. If you're not and you're poor, you struggle even more. So that tells me that there is a twin crisis, totally different to the ones we've discussed in the past, and we'll talk about the triple challenge. And I'm picking it up as a totally different issue within the triple challenge. Any views around these issues? And also, maybe you would list the priorities differently to me when I look at these two areas of education and health. What's your thinking around that and in the context of a future and a better, prosperous South Africa?
So the third aspect, obviously, is trying to find growth-enhancing interventions and reforms. I mean, so there are a number of simple reforms, interventions that you could have that actually kind of kickstart growth, I mean, and as it were. And part of it might be, incentives around jobs and also I think incentivizing employment of graduates, as it were, and a whole range of other things. I mean, around specific sectors where you do a bit of deregulation of sectors just to kickstart growth in those sectors and actually improve the environment. There are also a couple of low hanging fruits where registration processes and bureau and red tape at local level that you could actually quickly deal with, et cetera, et cetera. So the point I'm making is that I think on recovery, you could do a couple of things that help you bring the economy. We have an advantage because we're in a commodity upcycle, as it were. And I think it has to be used in very much to drive that. And second, obviously the second area is a kind of more long-term, which is, but also important for now, which is the structural reform agenda, I think. For me, it's not rocket science. I mean, some of the things that we need to do at reforming the economy in introducing reforms in the economy. They're difficult ones. I mean, like the labor reform, as it were, that's a difficult one, but they're easy things. I mean, that I think are outlined in government's Vulindlela program. I think it's the point is you need political will and political zest to drive them, you know, and not just talk about them in as part of programs, etc., etc. But also you need to kind of, in a sense, coalesce government into implementing these things. So state capacity is important. Now, rebuilding the state is a long term project, but I think there's a sense in which there are critical areas where you could assemble the capacity. You could, in a sense, partner with the private sector in more smarter ways to generate capacity, as it were. The third area is, I would argue, is dealing with instability. Or should I put it more positively, bringing stability back? And part of it, I think the bigger chunk of it is about, would relate to state capacity, just of the security cluster, just to be able to do its work properly. Now, there are areas where, investigative capacity of the agencies and stuff like that. I mean, financial forensic investigations are important, and you could actually see how you partner with the private sector around building those capabilities and ensuring that you use them more strategically. But government has to do that, because I think and just managing the crime situation in the country, I mean, reasserting the rule of law, as it were. And part of it is thinking more strategically about how do you rebuild state capacity in those areas, as it were. And part of all of this, obviously, is getting our education to work better. And the problem of education transformation, I mean, changes in education is like rebuilding the state. They take long. But I think you could have a more, if you like, shorter term intervention, which means get schools functional. You know, because the basic unit of education is the school. Get it functional, get some schools functional, improve school management in a couple of schools, and create examples of good functioning schools in townships, in villages, and et cetera. And also a focus on certain particular areas to rebuild teacher capacity in the school. But the second part about rebuilding education is probably at a short-term level. Think about strengthening district office and district management of education, because it becomes a resource for schools, basically. Because, I mean, the whole reform agenda of education should be about strengthening support for the schools. For schools and better management of schools, ensuring that learning and teaching happens. So to do that, I think you could start setting examples in districts and so on and so on. Some of these initiatives are driven by NGOs, partnerships with private sector, and in some district government itself is doing outstanding work in some areas. But this needs to be scaled up, as it were.
So how do we do that? And how do we scale? I was actually thinking of, as you just about to mention, business and business's role. Also, how does business respond to this very bleak environment you've painted for us politically, political decay, political parties, state weaknesses? We've seen the social unrest now. And we like you to see more hostility around the contestation for ANC positions in the local elections.
If I can add to that, because I have a question that's tagging onto the what can we do, especially linking to the commodity upcycle. I mean, a lot of South Africans are hearing about this commodity upcycle, but how do they become a part of it? How do business owners understand how value chains begin to work? I mean, we're talking about a potential reform of various industries, but will the reform period actually miss the commodity upcycle period we're working with? How do these periods need to coincide before they even take place? And again, how are ordinary South Africans able to envision their broader role in what South Africa wants to offer?
A couple of things to say. I mean, Arena, the first is that I think the for me, I think you have examples. I mean, when countries commodity-based economies like ourselves, I mean, those that become successful and transform and reform economies, they do so because by and large, you have a lot of the kind of benefit coming from commodity upcycles being directed to diversifying the economy, to strengthening manufacturing, to supporting small and medium enterprises, etc. And those that tend to be very unsuccessful are those countries that tend to use whatever comes out of commodity upcycles just for consumption. And in other words, it's like you kind of, as soon as you have this, you kind of plug it into the consumptive part of the economy. Now, the consumption part of the economy of our setup is important because of inequality issues and all the issues that you have outlined. But my view is that I think we need to use the commodity upcycle as government and in dialogue with business to try to drive public investment coinciding with to catalyze private investment into areas like infrastructure, into areas that like improving efficiencies of certain industries, but also creating better environment for certain manufacturing activities to take place. Areas like, again, I mean, in you would want to also direct a couple of reforms into the agriculture space so that you actually promote more participation in the agriculture sector, but also make our agriculture sector more competitive and focus on products that are more competitive in the market. Now, it's possible to do that, I mean, because I think we need to use these common platforms between government, labor and business, and more strategically than we have done. I mean, by and large, I think if you think about it, NetLeg has almost degenerated into a bargaining chamber. And you need to change that, I mean, so that it plays a more strategic role in driving a more strategic dialogue about growth, about dealing with inequality, about using the commodity upcycle in a more strategic way than just, yeah. So that's the point I probably would make. Is it possible to do that? Again, I mean, it's a matter of leadership, not just in government, but also in business and across society to achieve this. Leadership becomes probably, I would argue, it's a central feature of defining successful nations and failed nations.
Mr. Jonas, you just mentioned something about NetLeg and the struggles and just becoming a center for bargaining. How could we improve the kind of conversations that take place there? And also, what sort of trade-offs do we need to be pushing through right now?
Look, I mean, I'm probably NetLeg is, I mean, it might continue as it is. But I'm just arguing that you need platforms that combined big key sectors of society, labor, business, and government, and even civil society, in more strategic discussion about the future of the country and a new vision for the country. That's the point I'm making. I think, and my view is that you've got a lot of bargaining platforms that you could use, and certainly I would argue that platforms like NEDLAC would be better utilized to look at broader issues than just thinking about. So there's some rethink of institutions. I guess that's the point I'm making. There's some rethink we need to make around how do we build a new vision. Institutionally, what does that mean? What structure can best lead us to that point? Political parties are not going to do that. and my view is that I think, given what I've, my experience, I mean, I think you could see quick degeneration of some of these structures into bargaining and rattling over issues. You've got to look at that in the first instance as you move ahead. But the second point I think is that government has resources and I think I even in spite of the kind of fiscal constraints and fiscal challenges that we have, I think there's a need for government to think more strategically about reprioritizing expenditure and diverting expenditure to growth enhancing activities and so on and so on. So you can't continue running government as if you are in a normal situation. You know, it's almost like a war situation effectively that you have. Unemployment is a runaway train, unmanaged. The growth, I mean, we will benefit from the commodity upcycle a lot, but that benefit will be constrained by the fact that you don't make the necessary reforms to capture the advantage that's created by the growth. So for me, I guess the urgency is for me. I mean, again, the urgency is deal with the fiscal advantage. Because now you have suddenly a windfall in some instances, revenue that you didn't plan for coming because of the commodity upcycle. Direct it more towards growth-enhancing activities and really kind of look at expenditure from a number of ways, I mean, in a number of ways, but centrally also make growth and enhancing activities and job creating activities central to your criteria for expenditure.
Okay.
Tanisha, are you there? You're back online. Can you fire away your question?
Thank you, Sam. And thank you for this incredible conversation. Mr. Jonas, I'm really interested in hearing your views on this growth trajectory part that you mentioned and the structural reforms. Because in the 1990s, when we were negotiating around the kind of economic program that South Africa pursue as part of this democratic process going forward, there was this debate between the growth with and the growth through redistribution dynamics. And of course, the growth, employment and redistribution policy was kind of labeled as a kind of orthodox free market system, aligning itself very much to structural adjustment programs. And I was quite interested to hear you mention structural reforms and policies are linked to that. And just where does the balance come through in terms of the developmental approach to this whole process? How do we get that growth incentivization and the growth trajectory going, but at the same time realize that the development is almost not parallel, but almost kind of a pathway within the growth analysis we're talking about? So just in terms of the economic trajectory around our economic policy making and some of the issues in terms of the role of business, but also you mentioned deregulation. And I think our last speaker, Mr. Lewis Hill, was referring to business and deregulation as part of his mayoral candidacy for the city of Cape Town in the local government elections. And I'm just thinking about, you know, how do we see local government as that space that you really have to generate where this growth happens, but also bring in the development within that space? Thank you.
So let me come back to the issue. I think we have created a false dichotomy between growth and distribution and redistribution. It is indeed a false dichotomy. I mean, we've tried to sustain this dichotomy by saying that there was a period in South Africa where we had jobless growth. And the truth of the matter, if you look at the numbers, even in the period where we had growth, I mean, during the commodity upcycle at that point in time, job numbers grew, actually, in that period, basically. So my point is that I think in how we frame the structural economic agenda, we need to be mindful of the centrality of jobs, the centrality of addressing inequality, and build that into the narrative for structural reform. I concur with you in many instances. I think when you look at the way the package for structural reform tend to be emphasized and articulated, it almost like inequality reduction and redistribution becomes an afterthought. My view is that I think you need to look at growth in a context of an unequal society, and therefore you could say that you drive growth very hard. As you do that, you also build all measures that help you reduce inequality. It might be about how do you transform supply chains in the private sector, because again, I mean, and how you kind of the major trade-off in the private sector to say you would try to use your value chain and supply chains in such a way that you enhance participation of new entrants, as it were. Because I think it's very, very central, the issue of black entrepreneurial class formation, of black class formation, basically, building and consolidating a black entrepreneurial class. It's a very central project for transformation. And I would think that private sector should actually recognize that and build that into their supply chains as part of getting into the benefit of the reform agenda. So reform agenda and transformation and redistribution, for me, you should actually see them as connected. And in the way in which government manages and private sector look at it, should actually look at it in that way. And I think I had a chance of reading some of the reform documents, etc. Sometimes I still feel that we still drive this false dichotomy of not realizing that, I mean, there is a big space and a big need to increase the social relief, social safety nets in the country. But equally, I think there is a need to increase participation in the economy through jobs, through ownership, to entrepreneurial activities, and so on and so on, within a context of an economy that's growing and a growth strategy, so to speak. So for me, it's something that probably we could have that discussion more and more. But my view is that it's no longer an ideological point. It's probably, if you look in other parts of the world, it's part of a social democratic project that an unequal society has to go through anyway, as it were. So we are not building socialism, for sure. but we are building an economy that increases inclusivity, that increases participation through all different means. Education is central in that. Apprenticeship and all of those things, you build them into that project, as it were. So that's the first point I would make. I think we must avoid, I think we must increasingly, even our articulation of structural reform agenda, it should include the issues of inequality reduction. It should include redistribution, as it were, as part of it, as it were.
Okay, thank you. And we came to have Isaiah Mhlanga, chief economist at Forbes during the day, and he's a great South African, wonderful thinker, one of the emerging serious thinkers on issues with the economy and just public life in South Africa. Isaiah, are you there, my brother?
Thank you very much for the informative session and making the time to actually share your experience and thoughts. I just have a very short question. After reading an article from Mamoket in the Business Day, essentially arguing that we need to make the hard trade-offs and the poor can continue doing what they have been doing so that we can do the hard trade-offs that are required to actually provide the jobs. And now listening to Mr. Mcebisi Jonasi saying we may need to do a little bit more than what we have done in terms of cushioning those that are distressed from the pandemic. But that entails taking resources that should be used for public spending. Because if we analyze public spending over the last decade, it has been declining. And as a result, it has also led to the decline in private sector spending. I think it will be a fallacy for us to expect the private sector to invest with a lot of risks that have not yet been de-risked by public investment. So how do we make that trade-off? The need to support over the short term, knowing so well that we do not have abundant resources to do so without jeopardizing public investment that is so required to make sure that over the long term we generate sustainable economic growth. Because so far the debate seems to be focusing more on the immediate needs without addressing the long-term challenges that requires public investment. Because without that, the private sector is not going to come in play ball. They need de-risked investments before they can actually participate. Thank you very much. I'm going to stop there.
Okay. Thank you very much, Isaiah. Thank you very much, Isaiah. I concur with your points. I mean, in many ways. I mean, but again, I mean, I'm saying, I think probably we're saying the same thing in slightly different ways. But I guess my argument is, at the moment, I think if you look at our programs, I mean, if you think about around social safety nets and social relief, as it were, one of the things in my view that undermines the impact is state capacity, I think. And I think I would argue that you have a lot of losses that come through the system as a result of that. So my view is that I think you still need to drive that in a targeted way. And in many parts of the country, you probably need to scale it up in some way. I think a measured way, obviously, because you have to look at the fiscal resources available. But at the same time, I think if you have, as we have now, I mean, the commodity upcycle, it's the best opportunity to take advantage of, and incentivizing certain activities that are not happening or incentivizing some of the private sector initiatives that enhance growth and that also creates job, et cetera, et cetera. So in a sense, I think you, my view, again, I mean, I might be wrong about this thing. I think, I mean, if you look at the fiscal package that we have, I think there's a lot of imbalances. There's a lot of wastage in the way we kind of drive things. We still have a lot of vanity projects. Huge vanity projects that we drive, which have probably some of which have no possibility of having any impact in government. And we have not even sharpened the possibility of co-investment between the private sector and the public sector in key infrastructure projects, as it were. I mean, think about it. We've been having a debate in South Africa for a long time around the possible co-investment in our ports, et cetera, et cetera. And it's only coming to stream now. Thanks God that it is. But the question is going to be how sustainable it is and whether I think there is the political will to deepen those kinds of co-investment possibilities in our rail, in our ports, et cetera, et cetera, to strengthen our logistics infrastructure and better support our mining activities and commodity trade in for South Africa. So my point is that you could, in a sense, within the current envelope, actually, and also taking advantage of the commodity upcycle, use your fiscal resources in a better way. But also, I think we need to take hard decisions. I mean, if you talk about the trade-offs, you need to take hard decisions about some of the areas where we continue to spend lots of money. Sometimes just for kind of because we've done it before and we've always done it, so we have to do it as perpetuity. So my point is that there's a lot of reprioritization, rethinking around where do we want to our resources to go. That could actually free up a lot of resources for some of the activities we're thinking about.
Okay, thanks for that. Mr. Jonas, you've got to give us one or two examples of this vanity project. As you understand where you at about this.
Look, I mean, I just to give an example. I mean, you still find in a lot of arguments about the government investing or even supporting refineries, oil refineries, as it were. it looks nice. I mean, it's a big project and it's like, and so on and so on. I mean, to be honest, I come from a tradition where I once dreamt of a refinery in Kucha.
Oh, yes, you did.
into a long story. But I think the truth of the matter is that I think increasingly people would probably, many people would avoid such projects and maybe you kind of benefit better. I mean, if you probably position yourself in that space in a slightly different way. And then refineries are closing elsewhere in the world, in South Africa already, you're seeing refineries closing, et cetera, because, so that's one, is if you give you example and so on and so on. Again, I mean, you have like, I mean, in some places, people are thinking about huge dams that they want to build. I mean, like mega dams they want to build, as it were. If you really look at the economics and the developmental impact of them, you kind of start realizing that actually they are likely to kind of create any different development environment, as it were, apart from the resources that are used to build them, as it were. So my point is that you do need to be more strategic around. So for me, the government planning needs to really, really kind of be brutal in deciding on what goes. But equally, it needs to be brutal in putting the resources and capacities to drive that and drive them more efficiently. And again, I mean, the issue about certain infrastructure projects will be better driven if you kind of use public investment to catalyze private investment, as opposed to kind of think that this is a government project.
I don't think many people would disagree with you and that the public sector needs to start the process of leading to an investment. And also, Issa talks about de-risking some of the problematic areas. Why is this not happening? We've been talking about it for a while. And I suspect the incoherence in government that we had seen in the past still manifests itself in the state where right now everything is a priority. And how can we get our government to focus a bit more and on one or two, three priorities and help us move forward?
Look, I mean, at a positive level, I mean, if you have to be positive about these things, I think in government plans and discussions, I've seen a lot of improvement in recent times. I think I must actually say that, because I think there's increasing realization, and I think it's reflected in some of the focal areas that government is pushing. There's an increasing realization that resources have to be kind of allocated in a manner that checks impact and looks at impact, as it were. So I hope that gets strengthened moving forward. There's a lot of dialogue between the private sector and government on what needs to happen. And my view is that I think it needs to be taken probably to a level of execution, some of these things. And I mean, there's readiness across the board to do some of the issues. South Africa is a very interesting country in a sense. I mean, maybe other countries are, because I think the ideological issues in South Africa are still pretty strong. I think if you think about it, again, maybe arising out of the fact that those with economic power have no political power, and those with political power have no economic power. So there's still, a lot of skepticism about private sector in ways that sometimes undermine the possible benefit we could have on stronger collaboration and stronger partnership, as it were. But I think that the tide is changing. I see more pragmatism in different sectors. The one problem area is local government, I think. I mean, if you think that a state capture damaged the state in general, where this thing find a very devastating expression is in the state of local government in this country. I mean, it's that's where things are supposed to happen in many ways. And I my view is that I think you need models that ensure, because I mean, think about it. You would find in one area, you have a municipality, you drive 15 kilometers, you get into another municipality. So they have an engineer in that one municipality, and you can drive 15 kilometers. There's another municipality. They also are paying another engineer, and they pay another CA as a CFO. You drive. So you're kind of in an area where district area where probably they will do better by having one CFO and maybe combining resources around financial management and doing it collectively, creating a center of excellence on financial management, pay less and get better results, or in planning, infrastructure planning, or drive infrastructure and manage it collaboratively, as it were. So I think there's a kind of a rethink, because you don't have the skills available everywhere. So, if you look at some municipalities, they are HR budgets or COE budgets are bulging, and which means less money for doing their basic, providing basic services in this way. So my view is that I think there has to be focus on local government and in ways that we've not done before. And I think the current political system also will continue to damage local government, because I think if you look at the who becomes a councillor, it's a matter of local power dynamics within the ruling party and within parties, as it were. So sometimes those who actually ultimately become councillors is not the material that probably requires to be councillors. And they then kind of complicate it placing people in technical positions where this capability doesn't exist. So I think the political system itself is a problem. So maybe the idea of independence and so on and so on might also help, to try and change the situation. And the more our electoral system emphasizes on kind of constituencies and accountability, probably the more we could get better outcomes.
Oh, geez, on the depressing note, very, very depressing. I mean, when you talk about municipalities spending, not doing their jobs, actually, for providing basic services, I worry about issues like bulk infrastructure and spending around maintenance. I sit along these big municipalities, and you start wondering, in a municipality where there's little media and the reports of the Auditor General, and they don't get much as a scrutiny. But let's hold on to that. And Issa is back with another exciting question. Issa, over to you.
Thanks, Prasem. I think the issue of small businesses as one of the levers we could pull to generate jobs has been spoken for a very long time. Business leaders in the private sector say the same thing. Government leaders say the same thing. Labor says the same thing. But we don't see the funding that goes to small businesses. What is your view with regard to whether we are intentional about the small business sector as a lever that we can use to relieve some of the unemployment issues that we have and boost economic growth? Because if you look at the budgets of DFIs, how much goes to small businesses? A very small proportion. The credit extension from financial institutions, the banks, how much goes to small businesses? It's a very small proportion. But also a point that was made several times by the governor of the South African Reserve Bank in some webinars, that all commercial banks, they have developmental banking licenses, but none of them uses any of those to actually be developmental. Yet they are sitting on licenses which could be used by other institutions. Why do they have such licenses then if they are not using them for development? Is this something that we are actually looking at intentionally as a country to say, this is what we have identified and we are going to put our funding, our money to actually make this sector thrive? And I'm saying this in the context also, if you look at a local government level, the bylaws that we have, again, I'm going to invoke the name of a colleague, Mamukete, who again said this. I like the way that she phrased it. We are maintaining the aesthetics of a first world country in a third world country, in the sense that our bylaws are not quite conducive for small businesses. You set up shop outside your gate, you can make some income to support your family, you don't need a government grant. The Metro Cops are going to show up and say, actually, you can't operate that small business there because it's zoned for residential and not for business. And I find that baffling in a country that has 34.4% unemployment rate overall, but 75% unemployment rate for the youth. It just doesn't make sense. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Issa. Look, I mean, the small business is a big issue, I think, for me too. I mean, but I guess also in the informal sector, I think, is also so critical. I mean, I was looking at some of the countries where they have a huge informal sector and how it was able to escape the impacts of COVID, basically. I mean, because, I mean, the survival rate is very high, et cetera, in cases like that. In South Africa, I think there are historical factors. I think we come from a tradition where in the apartheid times, bylaws were all weighed against the thriving of the informal sector. And in many ways, many municipalities have just continued with those bylaws, I think, of not kind of actively creating environments to support the informal sector, as it were. And I would argue that I think that's something that I think evidence shows, that you could create a lot of benefit, both in terms of jobs and economic activity, by just having that thriving better, as it were. So for me, because the model that we take is that the informal sector must be turned formal, which is not, that should not be the approach. The approach should be support the activities where they are and create an environment that supports those activities at a point at which they are, both putting the infrastructure necessary for them, for the informal sector to thrive, but also I think ensure that you create some protection in terms of safety, et cetera, for that sector to thrive. The problem, I mean, small business, I think it's a bigger debate. I think small and medium enterprises, big discussion in South Africa, is a bigger debate. Because I always look back and think that part of the I think it's not one silver bullet will solve the problem. It's probably not just a funding issue, a financing issue. There could be a host of issues that we need to address to create a better climate. We also need to move away from the notion that small and medium enterprises in South Africa will only benefit from state procurement. I think that's why my argument about opening up private sector supply chains and actually kind of driving more concerted effort for supplier development and for supplier support and in many of the private sector value chains would actually have a benefit. So it's more than just like financing in my view. I think I still feel that supply chains in South Africa are still pretty much closed. I mean, and if you're going to drive a robust strategy for small and medium enterprise development, you kind of, again, that's another trade-off we need, where you kind of allow private sector openly kind of support and open their supply chains, create a kind of support measures of different sorts, to provide, to create platforms for small and medium enterprises. It's happening in some sectors very well, by the way. I mean, you've got good examples in some sectors of this happening, but I think you've got a poor performance in others. The supply chains and government equally need to do that. The problem, I think, with our small and medium enterprise support institutions, public support institutions, and ISA, I used to kind of, I ran one at some point, and I can tell you now, part of the problem is that the guys were supposed to provide finance guidance to the small and medium enterprises, themselves never ran any business. So you have a kind of if you do a survey of the kind of staffing and business advisors and what have you in the public sector on public institutions that are supposed to be doing this work, you would find by and large these are not occupied by practitioners, people with practical experience in running businesses, as it were. So that immediately kind of limits the scope and extent to which you could have impact, as it were. So in reforming the whole kind of infrastructure for supporting small and medium enterprises, I would argue that part of what needs to happen is to ensure that in the institutions that are supposed to drive this, you actually kind of have a fair amount of practitioners, people who come, who understand business, who ran businesses, who failed and succeeded, and so on and so on. So they know what works and doesn't work, as it were, to become part of that. But secondly, I think it's better also to have more tightly sectorally linked small and medium enterprise support initiatives. Because sometimes we have this general small and medium business support initiatives. I mean, if you take, for instance, if you say that in the auto sector, how do you build a network of small and medium enterprises? And you'll find that after certain unique, specific support measures that you need, and so on and so linked to the industry, as it were. So if you, instead of a generalized platform that deals with everything and so on and so on, and so you have people go around to say they are specialists in small and medium enterprises, I would think that you need to have more specialists in supporting small and medium enterprises in specific sectors. So that it's linked to a sector and it has a place within a sector. So I guess I'm arguing that financing is one part of the problem. The other part of the problem, I think it's a bit more complex than it is. Our whole institutional architecture needs to be revisited and looked at in a slightly different way. I also think that in other countries, you have a bigger role of research institutions and universities in supporting businesses and small and medium enterprises. And I don't see that coming through in South Africa, as it were. Skills are fundamental to running successful business. And I'm emphasizing it correctly. I'm not just saying degrees and qualifications. I'm saying skills, practical skills are important in doing some of these things. And you need measures to kind of steer people in those directions. So the link with training institutions, education institutions, research institutions, and as well as a tighter link with also sectors in, of the economy directly is a better model than the models that we have.
Okay, thanks. I'm wondering if Mamukete is there and maybe she wants to throw in input there. And we're looking to scale down from this conversation. So, but Mamukete, please, I'm quite keen to hear your views. And you've written some wonderful columns in the Business Day recently. And the issue of the basic income grant, you have views about it. And also the context of the trade-offs that have to be made for the basic income grant to be a reality. But also the opportunity cost of not doing the basic income grant. So please do come in, and anybody else who might want to chip in this conversation. Mr. Jonas, you've painted this picture quite graphically of the problems that we have in South Africa with a ruling class that is now economic power. And I wish we go back to that conversation. And because what it may do with the federal issue and that make it difficult for the black masses to take part in the economy. They see the public sector as the simplest way up the economic ladder. What kind of a future does it start the painting for us?
The nice thing about, the South Africa compared to many other parts of the world, I could have started by saying some of the stuff we're grappling with, everybody else in the world is grappling with. You know, so degeneration of political parties and depoliticization of politics. So you have increasingly politics without politics. So everywhere else in the world, think about it. Trump probably was a key factor where you have a politician with absolutely no politics, as it were. But I think politics, as we know them, is not just about, it's essentially about power, but it's also about a philosophical kind of orientation and some understanding of the world and so on and so on and so on. But if you look at some of the politicians and use that criteria, you'll actually realize that, it's lacking, not in South Africa only, but every Bolsonaro and other places and other people in the world. You see a similar trend. We have a crisis, as it were. So the advantage probably we have, probably I've been too negative. The advantage we have, I think, in South Africa, we still have, a functioning democracy, and I think people are still able to express their views on some of these issues. There is some level of public debate and public discourse happening, and probably we need to deepen it and so on. So listen to more ISAs and everybody else coming onto stream and have the debate intensified and so on and so on. Because once you do that, it rubs into what political parties start saying. I want to say that, the recent example is the kind of the land issue. I think you'll find that where it landed, it's not where it was originated. It was originated on Twitter. It ended as a policy of a political party, to be honest, to think about it in that way. So it ended up in parliament, of course, and so on and so on. So then, of course, because Twitter is an interesting book I've been reading, From Socrates to Twitter. So this is actually at the center of where we are. Public discourse is increasingly becoming poorer in terms of intellectual content and strategic content. And it's something that I think these kinds of platforms need to counter and have a more decent and more engagement around some of the problems. So there's a positive thing in that sense, but obviously there's a huge threat, I think. If you recall, in one debate we're having, I was arguing that part of the problem is political dominance and probably monopoly of thinking. Certain political parties think that they hold the term we used to use, they have hegemony over society in terms of thinking, as it were. So hegemonic politics are problematic in the sense that in themselves they don't allow space for engagement and different views emerging from different quarters, as it were. But again, that's breaking. That's getting broken very fast. I think, if you do a really thorough analysis of some of, I mean, Bell Pottinger reshaped thinking. You have now people like, I mean, talking about white monopoly capital, radical economic development, radical economic transformation, and all of these things. When you think about it and look at what it is, it's a kind of catchphrase, a reformulation that Bell Pottinger drove quite robustly, as it were, and gave it meanings that probably are not historically meanings that the liberation movement gave to those concepts, as it were, when they were used, at the time when they were used. So I'm just saying that I think the platforms are important, creating multiple platforms where there is engagement and so on and so on. It will ultimately start, I mean, if beginning to have effect on the thinking of those who are supposed to be thinking.
Okay. Jeez, I mean, it's very interesting about the development. I worry that their infrastructure is still active. We learned quite a bit from what they were doing in a bad way. Somebody is in court now, arrested for doing essentially what Bell Pottinger, the allegations, really, implanted in South Africa. But before we get into that, Mamkete, we have you. Thank you very much. Do you fire away?
Thank you very much, Mcebisi, for making yourself available. I was happily trying to lurk in this conversation, but here we are. But, you know, I'd like to have a bit of a discussion around the politics, because I think that's where a lot of the inertia around policy actually resides. You know, there's a concern. You talk about the loss of hegemony of the ANC as a potentially a positive development within the political sphere. But I think people are quite afraid that once you move away from that hegemonic position and there's a lot more contestation, you're probably going to get a lot more inertia in terms of trying to get policies, especially those ones that are tough to get passed, where there isn't anybody with a very strong mandate within the political system. So we hear a lot of reservations that people have around, for instance, coalition type politics and those kinds of formations. And quite a lot of people look with envy at, like, say, China, where the Communist Party has got, you know, supreme dominance, and Rwanda as well. How would you think about how those two balance off each other, like a lack of hegemony and pushing through tough policy choices?
Thank you very much. Look, it could be a long debate, but I can try to summarize. I hope I'll be able to do that. Look, I mean, the point I'm making is that I think the fact that the debate is ranging, even outside of political parties, has a huge impact in the thinking and the direction that political parties are taking. I mean, think about it. And I always use this example. I mean, during the period when the whole fight against state capture started, to be honest, the point at which we started getting momentum around it, it was when civil society was mobilized. It was when other political parties were mobilized. It is when business and everybody came on, and the churches came on board, as it were. And in a sense, that found expression in the thinking within the ruling party and as it were. So the point I think is that if there is a vision and perspective within the dominant party, hegemony works. The truth of the matter is that vision my own take is that increasingly I think we have gotten into a space where political parties have become about getting into power and sustaining themselves in power. And less we are finding that political parties are seized with broader shaping public narrative that is hegemony, and having hegemony in that sense of shaping public narrative and ensuring that people understand and their views, etc. I was making a point in another part of my discussion to say that, you know, I grew up in a tradition where morality, ethics, and political correctness in my youth was all ANC. You know, but I kind of had a rude awakening that actually politics are even bigger than the politics is bigger than the ANC, it's bigger than the political parties and morality in society is determined by society as opposed to it being determined by political parties. And in fact, I think that actually also a lot of other lessons we have learned over time that liberation movements are good at fighting for liberation. And I sometimes doubt if they are good at defending democracy. So again, I mean, I'm saying that's a lesson that probably we'll gradually learn as we go along, that actually defense of democracy is a society-wide project, as it were, if it is to be successful. And once you confine it to liberators who turned into rulers, you might just not achieve it. So I guess I'm saying that it's a complex topic, but we can have the discussion around it probably in subsequent discussions, because I guess I was just raising it in passing now, as it were. The last point I think to make in this thing, for me, our crisis is a crisis of a national vision and a national agenda. That's our crisis at the moment. We've become so fractious in that sense, and the question is going to be, how do we kind of coalesce forces into building and putting together that national agenda and that national vision? Now, and that's probably my space at the moment. And you can put it differently, Mamketi, and say we have a crisis of political agency, basically. I mean that to move society beyond where we are, you need political agents that are more up to the task and are capable of doing the work that you do. And probably that's a challenge that many countries are facing, the political agency crisis. How do you coalesce popular forces and popular classes and how into a movement that begins to turn the tide around? And how do you kind of coalesce different sectors of society in a direction that begins to build a kind of different direction and trajectory in the country? Thanks.
I worry, Mr. Jonas, we have 4 minutes left. You know, when you talk about the failures of the liberation movement to turn itself into a modern political party, and also the issue of principle you're raising, that liberation movements might not be the best guardians of our democracy, if I'm best to paraphrase you. And when you look globally with the former liberation movements, and the ANC used to benchmark itself against the Indian Congress, since disappeared. And also, we should look perhaps in Latin America. You could look at Mexico with PRI. Are there any examples we could be looking at in terms of the possibility of changing the liberation ethos and culture? If that fails, what sort of political outlook do we have?
Look, I mean, the thing is, to be positive, Katie must not think I'm too negative. To be positive, I think there are a lot of changes that have happened in terms of thinking, in terms of approach to organization, approach to mobilization, etc., that have happened over time. And I think many of them are positive, I think, you know. But let's face it, I think we've also seen, as you see those kinds of improvement and changes happen, you've also seen a reversal, trends of reversal, massive trends of reversal. And I'm largely driven by kind of some of the things that liberation movements are great at articulating, careerism and personal interest and so on and so on. So all of those things that people are kind of great at this thing. For me, I think that when you think about it, the agenda moving forward should be about a couple of things. One, I think it should be an agenda that I begin to recognize that corruption, state capture, is also tightly linked with the kind of, many people will say class formation, many people will say elite formation, black elite formation, etc. So there's a sense in which because again, coming back to the conundrum of those who hold political party, political power, no economic power, and vice versa. So you've got to ensure that if you are to build any transform agenda moving forward, that must include centrally a concept and a perspective on how do you build a black entrepreneurial class. That is a stake, a strong stake in this economy, in ways that I think we have not achieved up to now. So that's an important part of that agenda. The second part of that agenda is it needs to create a path about how do you kind of ensure that poor children from poor households can break out and poor families can break out of poverty, as it were. And what are those pathways that you could use for that? It might be education, maybe become more robust about education to realize that actually it could play a very crucial role in transformation. It could also be kind of equal access to opportunities. Because again, I mean, it's a different issue. I mean, if you think about it, we might say we have equality, but in fact, there's no equal access to opportunities. A child sitting in Kanduli wanting to be, or somewhere else, I don't know what else, part of the country, wanting to be an engineer, it probably has lesser chances than a child sitting in Sandton. So society needs to move towards a situation where wherever you are located in the country, what you want to be, you can be, as it were. And how do you do that in a practical way, as it were? So these are not just like ideological conversations. These are practical conversations that we need to have about building a kind of a different model of a job. It's even better now because we have technology. and so essentially, I mean, what technology means is that you could drive education outcomes better by relying on technology. And so on and so on. So, I mean, you could kind of have a slightly different concept of a teacher, as opposed to your traditional concept of a teacher in the story. So you could create a whole range of new dimensions that actually stimulate a deal with the issue of breaking the cycle of poverty for families and households, basically easily, as it were. And so for me, that's probably what the big message in the new agenda that we need to develop, as it were. And quite frankly, the debate at the moment is people are right sometimes by saying that sometimes the debate is tilted in the direction of those who have. Mm. And that's the danger. I mean, that if that perception is strengthened, it creates all sorts of populism and populist responses to what we are. But I'm still an optimist. I think I think South Africa still remains a great country and a huge potential. And I think we still have great people. I mean, in this country, I mean, irrespective of their political persuasions and parties they are located in. But and therefore, we'll ultimately find each other at some point.
So, Jonas, thank you so much, and thanks to everyone who took part in the conversation, and the team behind us, supporting us, Arina, Matlala, Mfobe, Puseletso, Richard, Sanusha. Thank you so much. And Mr. Jonas, thanks for gracing us with your presence. And we will carry on with these topics, and we will play a lot of them in the newspapers that I have an opportunity to write for, your Financial Mail, Sunday Times, Sowetan. And we will run a podcast that you'll see on the timeline, the exchange. And there's a whole lot more conversations we're going to have in the next couple of days. See you next week, same time, same place.